Right, good afternoon. My name is Nora Peel, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Boston Book Festival. It's so wonderful to see. It's so wonderful to see such a full house for this particular session. When we first invited Colson, several months ago now, I think we had an idea that this was going to be a big book, but we really had no idea just how big. So it's very thrilling for all of us to see so many people here today. I'd like to thank our presenting partner, WBUR 90.9 FM, for providing so much support for the BBF, as well as all of our other great sponsors. We also rely a great deal on individual donors and supporters to help us keep the festival free for everyone. And this year, we have a great and interesting new way for people to help support the festival. As you roam around Copley Square today, or as you go into our merchandise booths, you'll see some of our volunteers wearing red Vespa t-shirts. And that's because we're doing a raffle, and somebody today will drive away, possibly, on a new, brand new cherry red Vespa. Tickets are only available today, so your odds are good. And we've done our research, and we estimate that the Vespa glove box can hold 2 to 4 books. So we think this factoid will matter a great deal to one of you a year from now. Good luck, and thank you for your support. And now I'd like to turn things over to BuzzFeed's executive editor of culture, Saeed Jones. Thank you. Thank you.
Hello, Boston. Hello, Boston Book Festival. This is beautiful. I am so excited to be here to discuss Colson Whitehead's newest novel, The Underground Railroad. It's a treat. I would be here anyway, even if I didn't get to sit up here in this the good seats. My goodness, it's beautiful. Well, to begin, you know, during this complicated moral dilemma we find ourselves in, also known as a presidential election, I turn to our true moral center, Oprah Winfrey. Obviously, you know, one of the many praises the novel has received this year, it was selected by Oprah as one of her book club selections, which is, I'm pretty sure, why President Obama also read it on his Martha's Vineyard vacation this year.
Quite possibly.
He said. But this is what Oprah said, because I think she just got to the heart of it. This novel kept me up at night, had my heart in my throat, almost afraid to turn the page. Get it, and then get another copy for someone you know, because you are definitely going to want to talk about it once you read that heart-stopping last page. I absolutely agree. Colson, being the author of 6 books, has taken us from the secret life of the bureaucracy behind elevators, to the urban travails of zombies, to Sag Harbor. And now, with the Underground Railroad, he introduces us to Cora, a young African-American woman and slave who goes on a nightmarish Gulliver's-like travel as she tries to escape from slavery in the American South. And of course, because this is Colson we're talking about, there's always an element of magical realism or just pure imagination. In this case, the railroad is a literal railroad under the ground, which we get to see her using as she goes from perilous state to perilous state. And the results, the impact of this book at a particular American moment that we find ourselves in, it's not just intense, it's not just gripping, it reintroduces yourself to our country and to who you are and our history. And without further ado, I am so excited to have Colson read a bit.
Certainly. So howdy-do, and definitely so much thanks for coming out today, and thanks for the lovely intro. I first had the idea for the book 16 years ago. I was sitting on my couch and came across a reference to the railroad, and remembered when I was in fourth grade and I first heard about it, the words were so vivid, I imagined a literal subway beneath the earth that slaves would use. And then my teacher, you know, quickly explained how it actually worked. But I thought, well, what if it actually was a literal railroad? And It seemed like a strange premise. Not much of a story there, so I quickly added that structural element that each state that our hero goes through, South Carolina, North Carolina, is a different state of American possibility, like Gulliver's Travels. It seemed like a good idea. I knew that if I tried it then, I would screw it up, and so I decided to wait. And each time I finished a book, I would go back to my notes and think, am I ready now? And then realize that I wasn't up to it. And then about 2.5 years ago, I had sold the book to my editor, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to commit to this idea, so I told my wife about the Underground Railroad idea. In marriage, sometimes you have to make conversation, kill the silences. And she said, I want to say that book that you just sold about a Brooklyn writer going through a midlife crisis is dumb, per se, but this other book idea sounds pretty good. And then I was like, that's one. So I talked to my agent, who I've been with for 18 years, and told her about it. And she said both ideas sound good, which is not really helpful. But then she did something she never does, which was email me on a Sunday. And she said, well, I've been thinking about that other idea, and I think it sounds really good. I can't stop thinking about it. So that was two. Wednesday was shrink day, so I told my shrink about it. And she said, what, are you crazy? I mean, we both know you're crazy, but this book sounds really up your alley. And that just left my editor. And he just said, after I told him, giddy up, mofo, which is publishing speak for that's a good idea and we should pursue it. So I started working on it. In this section, Cora, our protagonist, is attending the birthday of Old Jockey, the oldest slave on the plantation. Whenever he senses a need in the community, he declares, it's my birthday, and it could be once a year or twice a year, and they have food, and they celebrate life in the midst of the plantation hell. The plantation is owned by the Randall brothers, James and Terrence. There's a reference to Caesar, who's a slave from Virginia. He'd been told when he was working on a small farm in Virginia that he'd be freed once his owner died, but his owner didn't tell her heirs, and so he was sold down south with his parents and the furniture and the buggy and all the other possessions, other property, and he ends up in Randall Plantation, and he's going to approach Cora about running north. And there's a reference to Chester, who's a young boy who's an orphan, basically like Cora, and Cora's taken him under her wing. The music stopped, the circle broke. Sometimes a slave will be lost in a brief eddy of liberation, in the sway of a sudden reverie among the furrows, or while untangling the mysteries of an early morning dream, in the middle of a song on a warm Sunday night. Then it comes always, the overseer's cry, the call to work, the shadow of the master, the reminder that she's only a human being for a tiny moment across the eternity of her servitude. The Randall brothers had emerged from the great house and were among them. The slave stepped aside, making calculations of what distance represented the right proportion of fear and respect. Godfrey, James's houseboy, held up a lantern. According to Old Jockey, James favored the mother, stout as a barrel and just as firm in countenance, and Terence took after the father, tall and owl-faced, perpetually on the verge of swooping down on prey. In addition to the land, they inherited their father's tailor, who arrived once a month in his rickety carriage with his samples of linen and cotton. The brothers dressed alike when they were children and continued to do so into manhood. Their white trousers and shirts were as white, were as clean as the laundry girl's hands could make them, and the orange glow of the lantern made the men look like ghosts emerging from the dark. Master James, Jockey said, his good hand gripped the arm of his chair as if to rise. Master Terence. Don't let us disturb you, Terence said. My brother and I were discussing business and heard the music. I told him, now that is the most god-awful racket I'd ever heard. The Randalls were drinking wine out of goblets of cut glass and looked as if they'd drained a few bottles. Cora searched for Caesar's face in the crowd. She didn't find him. He hadn't been present the last time the brothers appeared together on the northern half. You did well to remember the different lessons of those occasions. Something always happened when the Randalls ventured into the quarter together, sooner or later. A new thing coming that you couldn't predict until it was upon you. James left the daily operations to his man Connolly and rarely visited. He might grant a tour to a visitor, a distinguished neighbor or curious planter from another neck of the woods, but it was rare. James rarely addressed his niggers, who'd been taught by the lash to keep working and ignore his presence. When Terence appeared in his brother's plantation, he usually appraised each slave and made a note of which men were most able and which women the most appealing. Content to leer at his brother's women, he grazed heartily upon the women of his own half. "I like to taste my plums," Terence said, prowling the rows of cabins to see what struck his fancy. He violated the bonds of affection, sometimes visiting slaves on their wedding night to show the husband the proper way to discharge his marital duty. He tasted his plums and broke the skin and left his mark. It was accepted that James was of a different orientation. To hear his valet prideful tell it, James confined his erotic energies to specialized rooms in a New Orleans establishment. The madam was broad-minded and modern, adept in the trajectories of human desire. Prideful's stories were hard to believe, despite assurances that he received his reports from the staff of the place, with whom he'd grown close over the years. After all, what kind of white man would willingly submit to the whip? Terence scratched his cane in the dirt. It had been his father's cane, topped with a silver wolf's head. Many remembered its bite on their flesh. Terence said, "Then I recollected James tell me about a nigger he had down here, could recite the Declaration of Independence. I can't bring myself to believe him. I thought perhaps tonight he can show me, since everyone is out and about, from the sound of it." James said, "We'll settle it. Where is that boy, Michael?" No one said anything. Godfrey waved a lantern around pathetically. Moses was the boss, unfortunate enough to stand closest to the Randall brothers. He cleared his throat. "Michael dead, Master James." Michael, the slave in question, had indeed possessed the ability to recite long passages. According to Connolly, who heard the story from the nigger trader, Michael's former master was fascinated by the abilities of South American parrots and reasoned that if a bird could be taught limericks, a slave might be taught to remember as well. Merely glancing at the size of their skulls told you that a nigger possessed a bigger brain than a bird. Michael had been the son of his master's coachman, had a brand of animal cleverness, the kind you see in pigs sometimes. The master and his unlikely pupil starred with simple rhymes and short passages from popular British versifiers. They went slow over the words the nigger didn't understand, and if truth be told, the master only half understood. But they made miracles, the tobacco farmer and the coachman's son. The Declaration of Independence was their masterpiece. Michael's ability never amounted to more than a parlor trick, delighting visitors before the discussion turned, as it always did, to the diminished faculties of niggers. His owner grew bored and sold the boy south. By the time Michael got to Randall, some torture or punishment had addled his senses. He was a mediocre worker. He complained of noises and black spells that blotted his memory. In exasperation, Connolly beat what little brains he had left. It was a scourging that Michael was not intended to survive, and it achieved its purpose. "I should have been told," James said, his displeasure plain. Michael's recitation had been a novel diversion the two times he trotted the nigger out for guests. Terence liked to tease his brother. "James," he said, "you need to keep better track of your property." "Ah, don't meddle." Terence continued, "I knew you let your slaves have revels, but I had no idea they were so extravagant. Are you trying to make me look bad?" James's glass was empty. "Don't pretend you care what a nigger thinks about you." He turned to go. Oh, one more song, James. These sounds have grown on me. George and Wesley, the musicians, were forlorn. Noble and his tambourine were nowhere to be seen. James pressed his lips into a slit. He gestured, and the men started playing. Terence tapped his cane. His face sank as he took in the crowd. You're not going to dance? I have to insist, you and you and you. They didn't wait for their master's signal. The slaves of the northern half converged on the alley, haltingly, trying to insinuate themselves into the previous rhythm and put on a show. Putting on a show for master was a familiar skill. The small angles and advantages of the mask. And they shook off their fear as they settled into the performance. Oh, how they capered and hollered, shouted and hopped. Certainly this was the most lively song they'd ever heard. The musicians, the most accomplished players the colored race had to offer. Cora dragged herself into the circle, checking the Randall's brothers' reactions on every turn, like everyone else. Jockey tumbled his hands in his lap to keep time. Cora found Caesar's face. He stood in the shadow of the kitchen, his expression flat. Then he withdrew. You! It was Terence. He held his hand before him as if it were covered in some eternal stain that only he could see. Then Cora caught sight of it, the single drop of red wine staining the cuff of his lovely white shirt. Chester, the boy, had bumped him. Chester simpered and bowed before the white man. Sorry, master, sorry, master. The cane crashed across his shoulder and head again and again. The boy screamed and shrank to the dirt as the blows continued. Terence's arm rose and fell. James looked tired. One drop. A feeling settled over Cora. She'd not been under its spell in years. Ever since she brought the hatchet down on Blake's doghouse and sent the splinters into the air. She'd seen men hung from trees and left for buzzards and crows. Women carved open to the bones with the cat of nine tails. Feet cut off to prevent escape, and hands cut off to stop theft. She'd seen boys and girls younger than this beaten and had done nothing. This night, the feeling settled over her heart again. It grabbed hold of her, and before the slave part of her caught up with the human part of her, she was bent over the boy's body as a shield. She held the cane in her hand like a swamp man handling a snake, and saw the ornament at its tip. The silver wolf bared its silver teeth. Then the cane was out of her hand. It came down on her head. It crashed down again and again, and this time the silver teeth ripped across her eyes and her blood splattered the dirt. Thanks.
Well, everyone join me in a collective whoo!
Sure.
Let it out. Let it out. Amazing. It's such one of the parts of the book that really struck me, because the moment where you say the slave part of her didn't catch up with the human part. She's acting before she's even aware of what she's doing. She's just protecting this younger boy. Did you ever wince yourself when you were writing?
Yeah, I mean, mostly when I was doing the research, and you know, I have my 8-year-old acquaintance with slavery, watching The Roots with my family, in college reading histories, and then over the years reading this or that about it. But I hadn't done such a deep dive into just the sheer brutality of the system. And so the more I'd read slave narratives and histories of the railroad and slavery, the more I got horrified with my adult reckoning of what slavery meant,
you know,
sort of middle-aged, what it means to contemplate a parent being whipped in front of you, stolen, families torn apart, torture, rape, just the daily sort of mundane violence of the system to keep people in their place. And so I had an idea of what Cora would have to go through, and then the more I researched, the more I realized that just in order to be realistic. Terrible things would have to happen to Cora and the supporting cast, just in terms of making an accurate depiction of the plantation system.
Mm. How did Cora come to you? Was she always going to be the protagonist of this story?
Well, I mean, yeah, I had the, you know, the idea many years ago, and I had different ideas. You know, I would write a note maybe once a year, like, white supremacist state, ? And so I wasn't, I was, you know, toying with ideas in the back of my head, and at one point, the hero was a hero, and a guy just running north. It was a husband looking for his wife, a parent looking for a child. And then I hadn't explored a mother-daughter relationship before, so that became impetus. I'd had a string of male protagonists in previous novels, so to mix it up. One of the first slave narratives I read in college was the story of Harriet Jacobs, who ran away from her master in North Carolina and spent 7 years in an attic waiting for passage out of the city. And so I wanted to pay tribute to that. Mm-hmm. And then also, just the female slave experience is different than the male experience. Once you hit puberty, you're supposed to breed so you can make more slaves. More slaves means more money, more hands to pick cotton, more bodies to sell. So you become a cog in this economic engine of slavery. You're prey to the desires of your master and other slaves. So that seemed just very complicated and a challenge worth taking on to, you know, try and depict that.
Yeah, it's interesting in at this moment, the last few years, you know, the way slave narratives have emerged and been emphasized, certainly in films, Django, 12 Years a Slave, on television shows. There's even, you know, The Underground Railroad is a show itself. Your book, there's another book out this year about the Underground Railroad. But what I found so striking is your willingness to center a woman in this story, because I think, unfortunately, aside from like the narrative of Harriet Jacobs, we don't get to see or are not challenged to think about the way slavery impacted what it meant to be a woman, and the threat of rape and sexual assault is throughout the novel's landscape. Was that something you was that a point you were trying to make, or was it like you were saying simply just being realistic?
It was really just being realistic. I mean, before I deform reality and go to these alternative states of America, I wanted the plantation section, Georgia, the first state, to be historically accurate. In order to honor my, I don't know where my great-great-great-grandparents lived and died. Was it in Georgia, Florida? What kind of plantation they suffered on? So just to honor them, the nameless people who suffered so that they could pass on a little DNA that eventually became, you know, my family. I wanted to be accurate. And then in trying to contemplate what plantation psychology, it had to be realistic to me as someone writing in 2015. Mm-hmm. I was writing the book last year. So trauma, how does trauma affect people, and how does it stay with you for decades and determine everything your whole life? And so even though Cora escapes, her psychology is deformed by the plantation experience, and can she learn to love, and it affects her idea of what freedom is. And so as someone who's a 21st century writer trying to make a psychologically rich portrait of plantation life was important to me.
Mm-hmm. Were there parts of the book, I know you've talked before about outlining and then the joy of when you get to kind of break out of what you thought you planned. And so in the book we get to see, is it, I guess, four states, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and then she makes it to another state that I won't.
Sure, yeah, a few states, so yeah.
Were there states that you thought about including or left out? How did you kind of create this particular path for her?
Yeah, for the years it was in the back of my head, it was really just sort of, you know, she could have started in Florida and gone to Georgia as her first escape state. It was really, I mean, in the end, South Carolina versus North Carolina is really, it was sort of random, because the states are alternative and don't reflect necessarily the history of the actual states. And so I do a lot of planning and outlining, you know, I have to know the beginning and the end, but the middle is always, can be fuzzy in a good way. And so when she goes to Indiana, it could have been Illinois, it could have been Ohio, depending on just how I was feeling that day. I finally had to write that section. And so I am sort of a bit of a fascist about planning things, but then also you have to be open to that random creative, energies. You know, people ask where your names come from, and sometimes they're really planned, and then sometimes just random. If I see my friend Chris on Tuesday, and Wednesday I have to come up with the name of a villain, evil slave master Chris,
Did you have to change anyone's name? Like, oh, can't have Deborah be the slave master's wife. They're complicated.
No, I let it stick usually.
Amazing. So I wanted to talk about, South Carolina? Because eugenics and the way the history of race and medical treatment kind of come into form, where it seems mysterious experiments are being done on the slaves. Can you kind of talk about that section and what you were exploring?
Well, once I make the decision to make the road literal, mm-hmm. it's not a historical novel anymore, and I can, that's a big deformation of reality. And so I was allowed to just make it not about slavery, about race in general, and have a larger conversation about oppression. And so how the black body is treated in 1840 versus, say, 1910, 1920s during the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, I can open up a larger discussion of state oppression of black people. There's a white supremacist state in the book, and we think of Harriet Jacobs in an attic, you think Anne Frank, and then how can I make this white supremacist state, which oppresses black people, also speak to Nazi Germany and 1930s? How can I take the racial language of the Nazis and graft it onto the racist language of oppressors in America? And so, because I'm not writing a historical novel, I'm not going to lose my membership in Historical Writers Guild of America. I can play with reality in order to make a larger discussion mm-hmm. of the other and the demonization of the other.
Right. As I was reading the novel earlier this summer, an idea that I had not really gotten to think about in thinking about slavery was surveillance. Over the course of the novel, we're seeing obviously people who are still enslaved, but we're also seeing recently freed slaves. We're seeing people who were born free. And what I thought was so interesting was the way you examined how, because freedom was so tenuous, because you could send your son or daughter out to go get water, right? And your child could get kidnapped and taken back into slavery. There was such a difficult relationship with the people in power, right? The rulers. And so often people would have to kind of surveil and tell on neighbors and tell on friends who are, whether you're on the plantation and someone was thinking about escaping, or when Cora's on the run, someone turns her in. And I'd never thought about that before, the way slavery made everyone an accessory, really, to the crime. And what do you want to talk about that? It's so odd.
That's the way it worked. I mean, if you... there were so many different ways of enforcing the slavery system. Mm. If you taught your slave to read in a really deep southern state during the waning days, you could be sent to jail for teaching your slave how to read. Obviously, if you abated in the escape of a slave, your white person, you could be jailed or fined. So it was against the law right. to help people right. escape. And so you have to decide for yourself, are you going to vote with your moral conscience? Do you not even care about slavery? I mean, I think there are different kinds of black people in the book and also different kinds of white people. Mm-hmm. There are slave masters who are obviously invested and trapped by the slave system. There are abolitionists in good places like Massachusetts, who are helping and people bring north and give them opportunity once they get north. And then also, as we are today, there are people who actually don't care. Mm. And so in the same way we're not up night, not all of us are up late at night thinking about Syria, some people just actually don't care about slavery. They don't care. They're just putting food on the table and aren't that invested. And so... over the course of the book, I try to have just a huge chorus of people to represent different mm-hmm. People who have little power, a lot of power, are indifferent to the system. And because the book is rebooting every 60 pages as she gets to a new state, I'm allowed to have those different kinds of people in there.
Yeah. It was over the course of the book, because of the journey, and we're seeing so many different personalities and communities, it was like just like turning a cut stone and seeing the different facets. And unfortunately, the stone itself is slavery as a system. What's it been like being out in public, you know, reading this book, you know, being in a church and reading a section that really, you know, gets to the heart of a part of American history that often we prefer not to talk about?
Well, I read in a church for the Morristown Book Festival 2 weeks ago, and I usually curse a lot more. And then somebody was like, you know, thanks for your book and thanks for reading, but watch your language in church. So,
were you pulling punches?
I said mofo.
Oh, okay.
You know, so that's one thing.
You know, we're on hot mic. It's a big deal these yeah. days.
So,
be careful, honey.
So, I lost my...
Sorry. You're in Morristown, and they told you to watch your language.
Yeah, yeah.
As you were signing the book.
So, I mean, I usually, you know, do start telling jokes, like, uh-huh. oh, my shrink said this, and then I get into that really brutal passage, and then, like, I have learned to, like, sort of feel the audience understand, like, what's happening, and whether you've maybe read the book, and you're like, oh, something bad's going to happen in four pages, or uh-huh. you haven't. So there's that whiplash of coming out of... He's joking, and then he actually goes this really serious thing. Yeah. So I've never... Usually my readings are much smaller, my previous books. And so having people respond to this way, you know, ever since it came out, it's been a very different experience, you know, taking the book on the road. And I definitely hadn't thought about slavery in such a deep way before I wrote the book, and then people are, you know, saying I hadn't thought about how terrible it was, or hadn't had such a this kind of panorama view of the different ways slavery existed and the systems that kept it in place.
Has there been maybe a question from a reader or reaction or something pointing out a detail that you just hadn't expected when you were writing? Or did you even think about that? Why would you? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, nothing is sort of striking me offhand. I mean, there's someone who'd been a rape survivor and it was an early response to the book and said that I'd sort of, you know, in chorus psychology had captured an aspect of that experience that rang true for her, maybe not for everybody. So that was important. I mean, I think people say, like, ask me, like, is it hard or why do you want to have a female protagonist? And for me, it's just, you just write different characters, and it's your job. And it's hard if it's a woman or if it's a man. You know, if it's easy, it's not worth doing. Mm. And it should be hard, no matter whether the character is close to you or not. So, on the one hand, I think that's just my job. But then I also am glad when people say, "Oh, you got this kind of aspect of experience that rings true for me."
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the praise for a second, because, you know, you've written six books. They're all wonderful, from, you know, The Intuitionist, Sag Harbor, Zone One, John Henry Days, and now, you know, National Book Award finalist for fiction this year. You've received the MacArthur Genius Grant in the past. What's it like receiving such tremendous and well-deserved praise at this point in your career?
Well, I mean, it is very different. You know, I have gotten great reviews and, you know, great grants, and so I have had that kind of affirmation before. Not on this level. You know, I'm like, oh, the line at the checkout at the supermarket is so long, my life sucks. I'm like, that's all right. I think about death or Donald Trump. I'm like, that's terrible. And I'm like, you know. So this is the most sustained run of happy days I've had in my life, definitely.
Okay.
10 weeks.
A good 10 weeks.
So
that's what you said earlier this summer. You're like, good 10 weeks.
Yeah. So you know, it doesn't always go like this. And then 6 months ago when I sit down to work again, it's sort of irrelevant, just me and the page again. Mm-hmm. And so you're always starting whether it goes poorly or goes really great, mm-hmm. the next time you start writing it's just you and your strengths and weaknesses as an artist, and you're starting from scratch.
That's an important part of being a writer. There are two selves, right? So like the selves you are when you're out talking about the book and sharing it with readers, and then who are you when you're by yourself as a writer?
You know, my office is like down, we have a duplex and I'm downstairs and that's just my weird hell pit, you know. Like, should I take that fast food container out? It's been 3 days. It's like, no. Wearing the same thing all, you know, a couple days in a row. So, but I, you know, I just, I'm left to my own devices, you know, a couple hours each day. And when we're in a book like this, it is really intense and you are dealing with brutality and you're in it because you want to animate the characters and the story in a vivid way, but you also have to be detached to put together in a creative way. You know, you have to be in it and also a part as a creator. And you know, no matter what sort of terrible thing I'm working on that day, you know, 3 or 4 p.m.,
You're a father again, your husband.
Yeah, I do most of the cooking, so I'm just like, should I make this Sam Sifton recipe? Like, I don't know. It usually gets me. Okay. So, should I make this recipe or not and go shopping and make dinner? And, like, it was very separate. So.
Okay. Right on. Are we doing audience questions? Yeah. Okay. So, we have time for some audience questions. And there's some microphones. Two things. Please ask a question. Like, an actual question. No periods, no semicolons on the ends of those questions. Please. And while they're lined up, the other thing, someone from Twitter told me to ask you, what does Oprah smell like? The streets want to know.
Right, yes. It was very windy that day. We were out in her compound, which has a lake, like a man-made lake. Right. And so I just remember the gentle breeze, the crickets, a white dove landed on my shoulder.
Okay.
Like, hey, the white dove. So
that's exactly what should happen when you're hanging out with Oprah. Okay, so our first question.
Some writers have spoken about the disconnect they feel in talking about a book that they've already written while they're deeply enmeshed in another project. Do you feel that disconnect, and what are you working on now?
Sure, no, yeah,
beautiful.
Thanks for the question. I always take a big break in between work, and so usually it is separate. You know, sometimes I'll be asked about some detail in John Henry Days, and I'm like, I have no idea what happened. And that was 16 years ago. I don't know who you're talking about. James, like, who's that? But it goes from this very private thing. You're writing and writing, and then you give it to people, your agent, your wife, your editor, and it becomes a larger conversation. And so you're very fortunate when your book works, and then people just actually want to show up and ask about it. So I'm not working anything now. I won't until the spring when I'm sort of done talking and recharging.
Have you ever thought to yourself, it would have been a wonderful thing if we never had slavery in this country, if not a single African had been forcibly removed from the motherland, if none of the good... The question is, did any of the good that derive from the presence of blacks in this country outweigh the evils that derive from slavery? Would it have been a good thing if you and your ancestors and every African had stayed put where they belonged in Africa? Yes or no?
Stayed put.
Yes or no?
The question is, have I ever thought about it? And the answer is no.
Much better to be here in America?
It's like a weird question. I have no idea. I have no idea.
You have no idea.
Nice, sorry.
Woo, hi.
Hi. I've noticed that there's another book, The Underground Airlines, I think that's the name of it, mm-hmm. that came out, and there's been a lot written about, I believe that author is not African American. And so can you comment at all about, does it matter who's writing a book when we have sensitive subjects like the brutality of slavery?
Can I, as a male writer, write a female protagonist? I think you can use your empathy and imagination as a writer, and that's your job, to animate anything you want to. And that means people who aren't like you, people who are like you. I think it's your job to attack the world. And if you fail, you should be called out on it. And then be adult enough to take the criticism and think, maybe I shouldn't have taken on this voice because I didn't have the imagination and empathy enough to pull it off and do better next time.
First, thank you so much for coming. Thank you. You had mentioned in the intro to the book that you weren't sure about what chapters would go where chronologically, correct? How far deep into the story were you when you decided what to do?
I think I know what you're going to ask. So there are different plot threads, different revelations in the book, and there's the main line, which is Cora's story, and then there are different sort of biographical sections of different characters that I spotlight for 6 to 10 pages, and they're intercut between the longer state sections. And that was definitely what happened to certain people. In some cases, was planned very early. In some places, some cases where that chapter should go, I would move things around. There's Dr. Stevens, who's a medical doctor in Boston, and deals with his training. So after the South Carolina section, should I have him in that section, or someone who lived in a dorm with Cora? So I was always like, trying to figure out who should get those 6-page chapters and where they should go. And in the case of the thing I think you're about to ask, I was about 2/3 of the way through the book.
Thank you.
He's very deft at avoiding spoilers. It was very good.
I read your amazing book in August, and I kind of haven't been able to read anything else since, so I'm listening to it on tape now and picking up all kinds of other things.
It's become a way of life. You okay?
It's a very intense book. So I have two questions I'm going to sneak in there. The first one is, in your development of Cora as a character, there's this incredible line when Caesar asks her to escape with him, and she at first says, no, and then she says yes, and it's her grandmother speaking when she says no, and it's her mother speaking when she says yes. So I want you to tell us a little bit about developing those three generations of the same female characters.
Sure.
Can I sneak my second question in too?
Yeah, I probably won't remember because I only have this much space in my brain. but you can ask again. Thanks so much for reading, and I'm really glad to have stayed with you. It was difficult to start writing because everything is so terrible. And writing the story of Cora's grandmother, Ajari, became a way to sort of an overture of slavery for me. And so in 6 pages, we get her abduction and follow her through to her death on the Randall plantation. And it seemed that was a good way to access different parts of the same experience that Cora wouldn't have access to. So having Dr. Stevens get his own chapter became a way to talk about a different kind of experience with slavery. I wanted the book, I don't name the year, but for me it was 1850. And so I wanted to be able to tackle the end of the transatlantic slave trade. So Ajari. So basically different people become different ways of accessing the slave experience. And so Cora, as a third-generation slave, has a different experience than her grandmother, and that becomes important on her ideas of what freedom is. And your second question?
And the mythic quality of Mabel being the only slave who never was caught, or we think she wasn't caught, was really an amazing device, and then you are devastated when you find out. I'm so sorry. Okay. Well, I didn't say anything just now. I actually didn't. I'm so sorry. They're going to hate me. Okay, the other question is, when you were just reading the passage about the drop of wine, are you referencing the notion of what does it mean to be black and the single drop of having a single drop of blood and how he was so revolted by that drop of wine? And I hadn't thought about that until you just...
Yeah, there was the one drop rule. And you have various gradations of, are you mulatto, quadroon, octoroon? And depending on how strict you were, if you had one drop of blood, you're African American. And your African heritage and could be subjected to various things. So yes, there was the one drop rule was a big thing back then.
Wow. Real attention to detail. Hi.
Hi, thanks again for coming. My question has to do with the process of your writing. You mentioned your research. Was that primarily reading and note-taking, or was place important to you, and did you do any traveling down south and spend time there in any particular sites, et cetera?
Yeah, I don't like leaving the house or people, so I'm mostly an armchair researcher, and there's a thing called copyright law, and everything that all the slave narratives are in the public domain. Mm-hmm. When the WPA collected in the 1930s the right. testimonies of former slaves, people who'd been kids or teenagers in the time of slavery, that's all digitized and you can download it from the Library of Congress. And two-thirds of the way through the book, I did go down and take some plantation tours, just like, I'll be a real writer and leave the house.
Was it helpful?
It just goes in there. I mean, there are two plantations. One is the Whitney Plantation, which is a museum devoted to slaves. And I got a lot of names there. You know, there are names of people who did work there. And, you know, I just pick up names of people like Mingo or Lucian, and that goes into the book. The heat, the smell, and the sound of the insects goes in there in little ways. And then there's the other plantation I went to, which is, like, used in Hollywood movies, Beyonce video, and that's devoted to the slave master's experience. And like the tour master is like, well, you know, slavery wasn't all just mint juleps and sitting on the porch. You had to keep track of slaves. It was very hard, the accounts. You go to the website and it's like, you can have your wedding here for an antebellum wedding experience.
Not all plantations.
Yeah. Yes.
Wow.
And, you know, if you want to escape from hotel chains, you can stay here in our hotel rooms. And so what I got from doing the field research is that great divide between wanting to acknowledge our history and then not at all. It's a theme park of, you know, swell people. Like Scarlett O'Hara, just like cavorting.
You know. Have any plantations invited you to read?
nothing that's gone through my various filters.
Oh, you never know. Wait for it. Hey there.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I haven't read the book yet. It's on hold at the library. I can't wait. But okay. When you're reading that passage and just in general, I know it's a book about history, but it's not over, it's still happening. And when you're reading that book about the kid getting beaten up, I was just thinking about the police beating up someone last week. So how did today's news inform you when you're writing this book? Did you think of it as the past, or did you just think of it as a continuing?
No, usually when you're talking about race in America, you're never talking about the past. And so I would just read in a history book about slave patrollers before there were actual cops. You had slave patrollers who would go to the plantations, walk the streets, and stop any black person they would see and demand to see their free papers. And if you didn't have free papers, basically, you know, stop and frisk. You'd be jailed, taken back to your master, beaten. If you ran, you'd be shot. And so this is the way slaves and historians describe the role of the slave patroller. They go into any free person's house and investigate and search. The language is the same as policing today. So I didn't have to force the parallels. They're sort of there. And I could just use the language from slave narratives to describe the attitudes of law enforcement towards black people. And weirdly enough, it does fit.
So just to follow up, I haven't read it, obviously, but does your novel address the continuation? Is that a theme in there at all?
In different ways.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi there.
First off, can I videotape this moment while I ask my question?
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you. So I read
We're all friends here.
Oh my God, yes.
I love it. I love it.
So I read the book last month, and after reading your book, I went to look into more interviews that had happened with you just to see more insight on why you wrote it and stuff like that. And I was on YouTube, and one of the questions, well, not question, it was comment. Somebody commented, and they were saying that, you know, as a black person, typically when we talk about race, we talk about whites against black people. But this was a black person who was saying that because you're a black person who talks educated or who acts a certain way, you're not really black, or Obama's not really black. Like, they went to say that educated black people shouldn't be the ones portraying the story of the slave because they don't really have a black experience. And that resonated with me because that's something even now, just the other day, some of my friends were like, you're not really black. And it's like, I am. So when you get comments like that, and I mean, have you gotten them directly? And when you get them, how do you respond?
I haven't gotten them directly, and that's why you should never go to the comments section.
Yeah, don't read the comments. Just don't read the comments.
It's the naked id of America.
Don't do it.
So, okay. No, it's a dumb thing to say. It's a dumb thing to say to you, and just say, oh, sorry. Sorry. When it happens to you.
Look out.
Yeah. So. We'll
throw holy water on us when we walk out of here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, sure. So we have time for one last question.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. So no pressure. No pressure.
I think this is actually a pretty good follow-up to that. I think a lot about the ways that, black writing is consumed in America. And, looking around the room, I see a lot of white faces.
Same.
Yeah. And so, acknowledging that, I think my question is always, first, I guess, who are you writing for? And second, sort of what is your anticipated effect on different readers? So I'm thinking about the tension between a white reader experiencing this as something that brings up maybe pity and sort of education. But I think of myself as a black reader having this experience of just a very different experience. And so sort of being mindful of the ways that I think black pain and the history of black pain is something that can be really commodified and consumed by mainstream white culture. What is there for you in that tension?
Sure. There are a few things there. In terms of my intended audience or who I see as my reader, when I first started and wrote The Intuitionist, I envisioned my ideal reader as a weirdo 16-year-old black kid like me who might come to the intuitionist and think, oh, I can do this, or it is a different way of thinking about race in America. And then I did my first reading and realized that there are a lot of weirdos there, but necessarily it's not 16-year-old black kids. And depending on the book, I got zombie fans with Zone 1. I got people who liked a more realistic direction in my work with Sag Harbor. And so I've learned not to think about who's going to show up with each book, because I do mix it up a lot. In terms of people's responses to this, black versus white versus black responses, we're all products of American history. I assume if you just arrived here 3 months ago, less so, but you're going to be quickly indoctrinated into how we treat people. And if you're a white person and your great-great-great-grandfather was a slave master and beat, raped, tortured people, treat them as human property, it's hard to think about that. And who are you? Would you have helped? Would you have been an abolitionist? Would you have helped smuggle people? Would you have been one of the people who don't think about slavery? Or would you have been part of the system? And if you're, say, third generation African American, middle class, and you've climbed your way up, how do you contemplate what your great, great, great grandparents went through? Torture, rape, the complete erasure of their culture, how do they survive? It's inconceivable. And so contemplating the black hole of slavery, which sucks us all into it, is terrible. Hopefully my book is big enough that anyone can pick it up and have a meaningful experience with it. And I think in the end, that's all you can really hope for your work, that it does, that it lasts, and that different kinds of folks who aren't 16-year-old brutal black kids can have a worthwhile time with it.
Thank you
Thank
much.
You. Thank you for your question. Wow. That was lovely. Yeah.